You're listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussion of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russ, and I'm joined by Todd, Dawn, and Miles, all of whom are very big fans of the novels we'll be discussing today. And we will be discussing the first two books in the Chronicles of Brendane by Lloyd Alexander, the book of three published in 1964 and The Black Cauldron the following year. The first two episodes in the adventures of Taran of Caerdalvin, an assistant pigkeeper who swept up in a world that's much bigger than he. Now, as we've just discussed with our group, we're going to try our best to keep these spoiler-free, but I gotta warn you that if you haven't read the books already, you should probably just get out and do that right now. It's going to be difficult for us to keep it completely fresh for you. Now, what I'd really like to start is discussing how we actually came to know and love these books. So, if I could, Miles, did you want to go ahead and tell us how you discovered the books and what your personal experience of them are?
Sure. I came across the first book in my middle school library, and I liked the look of the cover, and the title sounded interesting, so I read it. That was in sixth grade. I was 11 years old. I really liked it, but I wasn't really into reading at the time, so I didn't get into the series at that point. It was a year later that I remembered that book and thought, oh, I kind of like to read the rest of the series. Where can I find them? And then I happened to discover that I already had the second one that somebody apparently had given me as a present several years earlier, and I had put it away without really bothering with it. So it seemed very fate-ish. So I read the second one. I hurriedly found all the rest of them in the library, and I've read them about 30 times since.
And Todd, how about yourself?
Well, my story is kind of similar to Miles in that I remember I had a teacher, I think it may have been fourth grade, and she really encouraged us to read. And I remember going to the library and finding this book, and I was really impressed with it, to be honest with you, because it had a map in the front of it. I thought that was super cool. But then when I started to read it, I was like, man, these are really neat. And so that's just kind of how it happened. I picked them up, I started to read it, and I got hooked. And I remember being in class, because we had a time period in class where we could read, and I remember being so wrapped up in that book that the reading time had ended, and I wasn't aware of it because I was so wrapped up in the books. And then I went out and I bought the box set, you know, I saved some money, and I still have it, and it, you know, kind of has followed me into my adult life. It's been packed away in different boxes when I moved to different states, put on bookshelves, and I always said, I want to get back to these books and read them again and see if they hold water. And I remember picking them up a couple of years ago again. I had read them several times, you know, when I was younger, and then there was a long span of time where I didn't. And then when I picked them up again, I just loved them all over again. And that's kind of how I got back into reading them. So.
And Dawn, how about yourself?
Well, I came to them quite a bit later, I think, than most people. I was a real Disney nut when I was in my early teens, and my big dream was to be an animator. And so I kind of made it my business to study up on all their animated movies. And I had some kind of anthology from the library that went through the history of all the Disney animated films. And when it came to The Black Cauldron, which I vaguely remembered from my childhood, I'm not going to say how old I was in 1984, but I was old enough to know that it was around. And I remember being intrigued by the description of the movie, but also, you know, taking note of the fact that even in this book, they were very frank about kind of what a failure of a film it was, both as a film on its own and as a book adaptation. But what they said about the books really intrigued me. And I just kind of filed it away in the back of my head as, oh, you know, I should read those one day. But we lived in a rural area and I didn't have access to a good bookstore. So I didn't, you know, I wasn't able to rush out and buy them at that minute. But I want to say it was a few months later during the summer, I was visiting my grandmother for about a week, and we went into a bookstore in her town, and I stumbled upon the first four books of the series and loved the covers. It was the Jody Lee covers, which I'm still a big fan. They're still my favorite covers. And I know they say you don't judge a book that way, but I do because I'm an artist, so that's what I look at. And so I picked them up. I devoured them within a couple of days. And then ironically, couldn't find book five anywhere and went an entire year not knowing the end of the series.
That must have been torture.
Oh, it was horrible. But, you know, it was also fodder for a lot of good, you know, what if. I was able to kind of plan the ending on how I would do it. But I think it was an entire year later I mean, this is before Amazon, you know, there was nothing. You couldn't just get online and order a book. And I think it was a whole year later when I was again visiting some relatives in a different state and came upon finally book five at a used bookstore and finished it up, you know, that day. So there it was both a huge, you know, cathartic, oh, it's finally the end, and knowing what happened. And also, as we know, the ending being rather bittersweet, just that whole kind of, it was very emotional when I finished them. So I was at that point about 17. And I don't know. And just, they've just been part of my life ever since. They just hit me at a time. I had a troubled home life at that point. And the characters just kind of became very precious to me, and how I internalized the story, and it helped me deal with some of the issues that I had growing up. And then I think, like all of us as adults, when we reread the books, we find new insights, you know, continually as we visit that again. So they've been part of my life ever since. I tell people, you know, for 20 years, these have been my obsession, and I guess there are worse obsessions to have. So.
So Dawn, I actually came about the books in a similar way that you did. I have always been a huge fan of Sleeping Beauty. I really enjoy the pure evil of Maleficent, and how it's a Disney movie that isn't extraordinarily bubbly and isn't super silly. So I was looking for other, you know, good Disney villains, and came across this Horn King and the Black Cauldron. I watched it, and it was okay. I didn't dislike it, but I didn't love it. And then maybe about 5 years later, I said, you know what? I remember that movie. I also remember, didn't they make a book out of it? I was digging for literature. And came across it in the library and went, oh, wow, this is a lot older than I thought it was going to be. And I actually read that one first and enjoyed it so much that I went back and got the entire series and have since read it at least three or four times. And now I am reading it to my 7-year-old son. And we are going through book five, nearly at the finish now. And I never got around to reading the stories, The Foundling.
Those are great.
So we will be finishing that up shortly thereafter.
I've never read that one either.
Oh, you have to finish them, man. That's part of the cycle. You can't get a complete
We'll be getting to that as soon as he finishes with The High King, which it won't be much longer.
Well, if you get a 7-year-old to sit through them, that's impressive. I've tried to read them to all three of my kids, and they just have no patience to sit there. It's kind of breaks my heart. We have to do the audiobooks in the car. Then at least they're a captive audience. They can't get away.
Okay, so speaking of the audiobooks, I think that, and his name is escaping me, but I think that the narrator does a terrific job, especially with all of the characters, except for two of them. I really do not care for his interpretation of Glue and Gwistle. And obviously Glue's doesn't show up till the third book, but Gwistle. How do you feel he does in general, and then specifically with those two characters?
You asking anybody specifically?
Has heard it.
Okay. I'm trying to picture their voices in my head.
I haven't heard past the first book, so I can't speak for either of those. Mm. But I do say I really dislike, and it could be that because in my head it's my voice. But I really do not like how he does Eilonwy. It could just be because it's a man doing a girl's voice, but the accent that he gives her is very off-putting to me. But that's entirely personal preference. She is the most precious character to me, and she's very, very specific, as everybody that's familiar with me and my work knows. So it's possible I couldn't be pleased at all. But everybody, I love how he does like Cole. I thought he did a very nice Gurgi. I think most people tend to think of Gurgi either as the one from the Disney film, or they think of a more kind of Gollum-esque. And so I liked that he really shied away from both of those.
Okay. Movie Gurgi was rather atrocious.
Yeah, God, it was awful.
So I would like to touch on the story a little bit now. I'm going to ask for volunteers. Does anybody like to gloss over the story of the Book of Three?
I could.
Go for it.
Please do, Miles.
All right. So Book of Three starts out with Taran, teenager, farm boy, wants to be a war hero, have lots of glory. All he has to do, his only task is to help take care of the pig on the farm. And so it's like adding insult to injury. Not only is he not just a pig keeper, but an assistant pig keeper. So lowest of the low. Turns out the pig is somewhat of an oracle. It can tell the future, tell things people can't know by any normal means. And suddenly she often runs because she senses danger. Tarn chases after her, ends up getting lost in the woods. He stumbles across a warrior named Gwydion, who's come to ask Henwen's help in finding out what sort of danger is building in Prydain. The ever-present danger is from the land of Anuvin, which is ruled by Aron, Lord of the Dead, who wants to conquer Prydain and enslave everybody. So together they look for the pig, but end up discovering that Aron has sent his champion, the Horned King, a scary guy with a skull for a head and antlers, to invade Cair Dathil, the capital city. So they decide our mission has changed. We have to go warn Cair Dathil that there's this invasion force. They set off to try and do that. They get captured along the way. Gwydion appears to die. How far do you want me to go without giving away spoilers?
I think we're good for spoilers in the All book right. of three.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
That's our general podcast rule of thumb.
All right.
The book we're talking about is going to be spoiled.
Yeah. Maybe just to summarize the rest of it, Kitaran makes it his own quest to warn Cair Dathil of the invasion, and he picks up a few companions along the way. There's Princess Ailanwy, who is an enchantress in training, Fluter Flam, who is a bard and is actually very good at it. The only problem is his harp is enchanted, and whenever he tells a lie, like bragging about something, exaggerating about how many enemies he fought, one of the strings on the harp breaks and he has to repair it. Gurgi, who seems to be part human, part animal, not quite either, but and sort of an outcast, but and Tarn has a bit of a challenge getting along with him, but eventually accepts him. And Dolly, the grumpy dwarf, who wants to make himself invisible. And so together they form a band and go on their quest and do their best.
That's pretty good.
So one of the things I noticed as a major theme in the entire series, and it starts from the very beginning, is the foreshadowing. And in particular, some of the weaving of the various threads together. You can see that in the very beginning when Tarn meets Gwydion. Gwydion is weaving bits of grass together for magical purposes. You can see that even furthermore in some of the other books. Did you guys pick up on some of this foreshadowing and in a way that is as spoiler-free as possible, notice anything like that?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lord Alexander was very good at that, planting seeds early on and then bringing in some sort of big revelation that seemed that is surprising, but then you realize, oh, yeah, that was set up back there.
Mm-hmm. Even the first page, you know, he's at a forge, and without even talking too much, I know we're not getting into the later books, but
right.
These are all things that he winds up doing later as he's, you know, wandering.
Right. I noticed that a lot of times there's some sort of wisdom kind of imparted right in the beginning, and then Tarn finds out on his own that wisdom is true. You know, when Cole is talking about, you know, or maybe it was Dalvin talking about how, you know, a sword is basically just a piece of metal twisted into an ugly shape. Mm-hmm. Cole was always talking about how he was, you know, there's more honor to be found in sowing your garden than fighting in war. And at the time, Tarn kind of scoffs at that, but as he gets older and more, I think it's, you know, we all do that as adults, as children. We look at our parents or whatever, and they don't know anything. And then we get over it. Wait, they know a lot. It's like that in the books, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely one of the big themes I picked up on is just what I call the wisdom of Gwydion. Of course, it comes also from Dalvin and others, and you just mentioned it, Adain's big quote, I have learned that there is greater honor in a field well plowed than in a field steeped with blood.
That's it.
Or... Gwydion saying things like, I shall take the intention for the deed. You must learn to answer for your own folly.
Yeah.
He's kind of a walking proverb, Gwydion.
Yeah,
you know,
it really
it's
is.
A little bit difficult at first when Alexander writes in a very kind of stylized way. And it works when you're reading the books. But then later, I think Miles, you know, when you've thought about how you would adapt this or that for a film, and it gets a little bit, you're like, oh my God, can this guy speak like a real human being? But it is, but for what he was accomplishing with these characters, they all have very specific mannerisms and speech patterns that set them apart. And yeah, for Gwydion, it's always he's just this fount of wisdom, and everything, every word that comes out of his mouth is some.
It's great, because I run the Prydain quotes Twitter, and he's like, you know, there's always several characters I can look to, and he's one of them. It's like everything he says is perfect. It's great.
And every man are good and evil mixed.
So you also mentioned Flute of Flam and his character and his magical harp. I found myself, especially rereading, expecting those strings to break every time he opens his mouth. And then when they don't, I'm actually rather surprised.
Yeah.
Which, towards the end of the book, with dancing around spoilers as best we can, they do wind up at Cair Dathyl, and there is a bit of a skirmish there. And when Fluta goes describing it, it's almost very poignant that when Fluta describes this encounter he had, they don't break.
Right.
Right.
That's what makes it all the more dramatic.
Fluter's gold. He really is.
Yes.
The interesting thing, as you really examine the relationships between the characters, for the greater part of book three, he's the only adult in this group of these two teenagers that are constantly, you know, doing the teenager thing. And then this animal who's only, you know, half coherent half the time, he's really remarkably patient with everyone. He steps aside from the normal role of an adult and allows Taran to take over as the leader of this. And he really, he creates this wonderful sense of balance. He's kind of the voice of reason, but he never forces it on anyone. Mm-hmm. You know, he kind of is good at diffusing things with the humor, mm-hmm. but it's just, he's such a wonderful, and he's a very stock character for Alexander. If you've ever read any of his other works, there's always kind of this gentle wisdom character that's funny and yet very profound when you finally, you know, get past the goofiness. There's a strength to him. I always thought Fluter is almost a father figure, but maybe more of like a fun uncle, you know, to them.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that, him being the only adult in the third book.
Me either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, until Dolly comes along, and Dolly's, you know,
sure.
But even Dolly doesn't act like an adult. He acts like a petulant, you know.
And he also sort of outranks all of them. He's the king.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. He is the king. So he could pull rank at any point, and he doesn't.
Yeah.
That says a lot about him. As a
Dolly's like the grumpy uncle in the family.
Yeah.
Something's always making him angry.
Yep, Fluter does resemble certain stock characters in other Lloyd Alexander works, like Count Las Bombas in the Westmark trilogy.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that one. I know that there was one, the last book that he wrote, the Golden Dream of Carlo
Cucchia.
Cucchia. And there was a character there that was very Fluter-ish, and I forget his name now, but he keeps popping up. And I think, you know, it's often the voice of the author. And in Fluter's case, it's clear because he looks like, you know, Lloyd. He's obviously kind of a stand-in for him. And it almost kind of makes me think that it's like him standing there looking on as these kids that he's allowed to be in these positions are working it out. And he's just kind of standing there playing his harp and watching and composing the stories in his head of how he's going to sing it as he gets back to, you know. He's really almost like just standing back watching.
So that brings up a good point. One of the major themes, and I could say this genre itself, is the Bill Dungsroman. Are you guys familiar with that term?
Yes,
vaguely.
So clearly the quintessential coming-of-age story reminds me of many other books in this genre that I've seen. So the first thing that comes to mind after I finished reading this series was how incredibly similar to Harry Potter it was. And I'm wondering if you guys have noticed any other stark contrasts, or if reading this made you fall in love with another coming-of-age story in any way. What are your takes on that theme?
I think it's a pretty common theme in any kind of fantasy. You know, the hero coming of age. I mean, you think about a lot of books, the ones that I read growing up, the fantasy ones, Chronicles of Narnia, The Lord of the Rings. Those are the big two. But yeah, it's a pretty common theme. There's a lot of common themes in any, I think, good kind of book. But yeah.
One thing I noticed was at some point in time, Gwydion and Taran are separated, and when they get reunited, Gwydion mentions he was in a place called Eth Arnith. I actually went looking for a little research on this. I couldn't find a thing, but it did remind me a lot of, and I can't remember the name, but the Wizarding Prison from Harry Potter, the Dementors. What's the name of that place?
Azkaban,
of course. The title of the third book, and I can't remember it. Do you guys know any more about Eth Arnith?
Well, I've been, over the course of the last several years, I've been working on adapting the five books into film scripts, just in case that ever was a possibility. And I was curious too, and wanted to delve into a little bit more. So I did a little bit of research on it. There wasn't much to find, although I'd got the impression that there was some kind of prison that, as Gwydion mentioned in the book, it tortures not just the body, but the mind. It mentions a little bit of it in the Prydain Companion, highlighting that, because he spent time in the prison and also escaped, he was granted greater mental clarity, giving him the power to understand the speech of any living creature. Mm-hmm. And let's see, I'm looking at the Prydain Companion now to see if
that's
there's
any. apparently, it's originally, maybe he pulled that from the Mabinogion. In association with King Arthur, who had been imprisoned in a castle of FNNF. But it's very brief.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot on that one.
Well, the other thing that I'm going to mention about the Book of Three was Akryn, when you run across Akryn. Something that Dalbin says about her was, there are secrets about Akryn that are better left untold. Now, going back just to the foreshadowing, only reason I mention that is because it's one of my favorite aspects of the whole book. But in addition to that, after meeting Akryn, eventually Taran is able to escape from Spiral Castle. And at that point in time when he perceives Gwydion to be dead, he decides to take on the quest for himself, just as you say. There's another parallel there that I'm going to bring everyone's attention to immediately. We'll talk about it again after we discuss Book 5. But I found the quest that he starts at that point and finishes by the end of the book to be almost as prophetic or as foreshadowing as any other aspect. Now, if anybody else has anything that I'd like to mention about the Book of Three, please do it now. Otherwise, we can move on to Book Two.
I don't.
That's fine.
So, Dawn, I would really like to hear you give us your synopsis of the Black Cauldron.
Synopsis of the Black Cauldron. All right. Well, so it picks up, I believe, about a year after the events of the Book of Three. I think Dalbin even mentions at one point that it's been a year. Opens up, we see Taran back at home in Caer Dalbin. He's bathing Henwen. And over the course of the opening chapter, we're introduced to several new characters who are all showing up for what turns out to be
Council?
Council, yes. I'm sorry. I completely blanked that word out. A council being held there. So we get introduced to several new characters. We have the haughty Prince Eladir, who immediately upon meeting Taran, they get into a fist fight over his... Yeah, Taran insults him, and he insults him back, and they do the teenage boy thing. Then we get Adaeon, who is the son of the chief bard Taliation, and quickly becomes obvious is a character that is so perfect. He must be some sort of symbolic role model. And then we see Gwydion returning and Fluter returning, and we have a few kings coming. So there's a lot of very important people all converging on Caer Dalbin. And it turns out that they've come for a council that's been called by Gwydion. And Dalbin, too, I think, to discuss how to combat Aron's constant use of the magical cauldron, which is what he uses to steep dead bodies in and raise them again and as his cauldron born, which are the horrible undead warriors who serve him. And they figured out that the only way to stop him is just to get the cauldron away from him. And so they organize a quest to do just that. And Taran, who's very excited to be included as in this man's work, quickly is disappointed to realize that he's basically the rear guard who's going to be staying behind. He's going on the quest, but he gets to sort of mop up after everyone's done by staying outside of Anuvin and keeping guard and helping, you know, with gear and horses and things like that, which makes him very upset. He's also been paired with Elidir, who's extremely indignant at having to share in these lowly duties when they both want to do, you know, the glorious stuff. They want to be the ones to storm into Anuvin and rescue the cauldron themselves. So right away we have a big, you know, head-to-head conflict with the main protagonist in this particular book. Alanwi is furious at being left behind, and so true to form, just kind of ignores that and shows up later while they're all out in the woods somewhere. So through the course of this quest, through a series of misadventures, Taran is kind of left to not fend for himself, but left in charge of a small group of his own. And I don't want to give too much away, but they do in fact discover the cauldron. It's not in Anuvin. It's been taken back by the three witches of Morva, who live in deep in this marsh. And he winds up having to make a very, very important sacrifice in order to regain that. And it's a very pivotal moment in the series, and I'm sure we'll discuss that more in depth. After that point, pretty much the rest of the book is a wrap up on the consequences of that decision, and then the resolution between Elidir and Taran, and how Elidir's character arc winds up. And I don't want to give too much away, because there's some fairly significant spoilers in this particular book.
Yeah.
So eventually they do manage to do what they set out to do, but there's a lot. It doesn't ever look like what anyone thinks it's going to look like. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. So
the witches of Morva are very interesting characters. They seem entirely otherworldly. Reminded me a lot of Tom Bombadil in the way that when you meet Tom Bombadil, he just puts the ring on and it's like it's nothing. He's completely outside of the power of the ring. Just as they seem to be entirely outside the power of Aran or the cauldron. They even mention that Aran paid dearly for the cauldron. I was kind of curious, have we any thoughts on what that payment may have been?
I came up with a theory based on something I read in one of the Foundling stories. I don't know if I should mention it. It might be a bit spoilery.
I would go ahead and mention it. If it's too much, we'll cut it out.
Here's read the Foundling.
So there, in the story, the origin story of Dalbin, when he grows up and leaves the witches, so to speak, they offer him one of three gifts, and one of them is the sword, and they don't mention it by name, but it's hinted that mm-hmm. it's the sword Durnwin, which has a really, really bloody, messy history anyway. And so I thought maybe Durnwin at one point belonged to Aran, and that was the price he paid for the cauldron. It would probably be his most prized possession, since he's the Lord of Death, and that's mm-hmm. his instrument of death.
And that becomes extremely more poignant even later on. That's a terrific theory.
Because otherwise you can't figure out when they might have gotten mm-hmm. Durnwin and from whom, because Rita died at such and such a time, clutching it in the dungeons of Spiral Castle. So it seems to work mm-hmm. out chronologically.
Hmm. That's interesting. I'm going to have to go back and read now with that theory in mind.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, the witches are such interesting characters. I think you can find parallels with them in so much literature.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, the Greek fates come up, and then this very Celtic symbolism in the fact that there's three of them, and you know that you have the triple goddess motif. There's just a lot of kind of cultural richness that Lloyd put in these books by just, you know, he never overplayed it, but there's just those hints, those flavors of these different mythologies that he would put in, that just kind of ground them, I think, and give them a sense of reality that you don't get in a lot of pop fantasy.
I loved when they said, we do care, but except we don't really, because we can't, we're not the type of beings who can care the way you beings can.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, what are they then?
Yeah, they're interested in things as they are.
They're kind of otherworldly, and I mean, they definitely are, but you don't really understand what, you know, I don't know. They're just that so mysterious, so powerful. You get the
alien.
I often wondered why they disguise themselves as ugly women, but I know that was definitely a choice because. You know, they're kind of revealed as how beautiful they are at one point.
Yeah.
And I just wonder how they were so massively powerful that they just kind of entertained themselves and came down here and did what they needed to do. Mm. And,
I love that they're so mysterious because it would be so easy I think it would have kind of dumbed it down a little bit to have to explain every single thing.
Sure.
And Alexander didn't. He let the mystery stand. And that's very respectful toward a child audience to not feel like you have to and you know, describe everything and say, well, here's who they really were. Well, you know what? Just let it be a mystery. That's okay.
Yeah.
Right. So at one point, one of the witches actually mentions, oh, so that's a Gurgi. And of course the response is, well, no, it's not a Gurgi. It is Gurgi. Is there some significance to that? And then above and beyond that, we do see anthropomorphism in fantasy all the time. Would you say that anthropomorphism in this particular case has some significance towards the idea of becoming an adult, becoming a man?
Interesting thought. I mean, that is one of the overriding themes of the series, so that would definitely make sense. And Gurgi has an arc. You know, he's far more animal in the first book than he is in the last. He's clearly kind of evolving over the course of the series. So,
and Gurgi doesn't even know who he is, really.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
that's what you could say the same thing about Taran, I suppose.
That's true.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah, they said that Gurgi had the wisdom of animals, but had not gained the knowledge of humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's interesting. I still think he's a dog. I mean, that's my overriding theory. He's totally a dog.
A really smart dog.
A really smart dog that walks on a hind leg.
I must have seen one of the early covers because I think I saw a cover with that depicted Gurgi as sort of an ape-like creature. So that's how I always saw him.
I've always imagined him as much more human than any other illustration I've ever seen of him as. Almost like a Cro-Magnon.
Well, there is, and this one I know that he did get the name Gurgi. There's a quote from Alexander somewhere, and I'm sure Miles, this is probably in the companion. I'm sure it is, where he pulled that from some piece of Welsh literature, and it was a mention of a hideous looking gray, literally I believe it was translated as dog man or man dog, and it was a character in some legend or other, and it was a very brief mention. It wasn't even, like a developed character, but I think he just remembered the name and he remembered the description. And that was how he, started creating Gurgi. But again, I think even he had trouble remembering exactly where he saw it. I do remember that as I was reading that he couldn't even place where he found that particular item.
For me, the character of Gurgi has always just been, he's created, I think, for us to understand compassion. A lot easier because, Taran has showed that same compassion all throughout the whole series as he makes mistakes and Gurgi makes mistakes. And, in the Black Cauldron, in the Book of Three, Taran hated Gurgi. He thought he was just an annoying pest, but then he grows to love him and appreciate him. And then, even through to the end of the series, his character teaches us that even, the meekest characters can be brave. And I love that. I love that about him. I love him. You know, you kind of want to just give him a big hug.
Yeah. I felt like that was part of Tarn's maturity, his development of maturity, in that he grew to see Gurgi's inherent worth and dignity, even though he wasn't human.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he stunk. He was annoying. He was always begging for food. Maybe he was a dog, you know? I don't know.
So the other theme that I picked up on the entire series, and you can really see it very well in the first two, is what I would call the Star Trek factor. It's a very optimistic outlook. And in addition to that, the theme that there's a way that, that we can save everybody. And Tarn always looking for a third way. You know, I can't chase after Henwen and go after Cair Dathyl. I'm going to try and find a way that's going to make it work.
Right.
Being that this is young adult fiction, it fits perfectly. And I think that Lloyd Alexander has a way of making it approachable without overbearing. So I thoroughly enjoy the books. I don't feel like I'm ever being, you know, preached to or pandered to or getting a rose-colored glasses effect. But I wanted to ask, do you find that this theme in this series to be as well done as I feel like it is? And do you find, in general, you don't mind this theme? You dislike it? Obviously, with more popular literature like The Witcher or A Song of Ice and Fire, and by more popular, I mean nowadays, these are becoming more popular. There's a huge moral ambiguity. There's a lot of you know, very, very dark, mature undertones, and that is becoming more popular. So how do you think that this fits in the fantasy genre in that way? Is it too heavy-handed with that? Is it a good balance? What do you think?
I think personally, well, that's one of the reasons I like the books, you know, was that kind of that moral compass. And I agree with you that it wasn't too heavy handed. There's sometimes I had a personally difficult time. I kind of put myself in Tarn's shoes and think, OK, I wouldn't have done that. I probably would have flipped out on the guy or somebody. You know what I mean? But he always takes the high road. And I always appreciate that about his character. You know, I like those, you know, the positive morality in these books. I think it's powerful. And I think you're right. I think it is done right. There's kind of a good balance between, you know, that positivity, but they're also having to deal with some dark issues as well. Sure. They're just making the right choices instead of making the wrong choices, you know?
The villain is the villain.
Yeah, he definitely didn't shy away.
But he's also
very,
very serious. And then, of course, all the good characters are, you learn they're good, you know they're good.
Right.
Now, what other kinds of, you know, fantasy or literature, or just, you know, fiction in general do you enjoy? You know, I'm a fan of pretty much the whole gamut. I can appreciate books like this, as well as A Song of Ice and Fire. I like Star Trek, and I also like Battlestar Galactica.
Thought you were going to go with Star Trek and Star Wars.
I do like Star Wars as well. Okay. Star Wars is kind of like right in the middle. Star Wars touches all of everything else.
I mean, I get kind of the big ones that everybody else likes. I love Harry Potter, The Lord of the Rings, The Chronicles of Narnia. I did read a series when I was younger, and I want to try to read them again. It was The Crystal Cave by Mary Stewart. I don't know if anybody's ever read those, but they're about Merlin. And I was always fascinated with those books, so I'm curious to kind of track them down and find them and see if they hold the interest like Prydain held my interest when I was younger. But I kind of just have stuck to the main, you know, the main ones everyone else has read. So.
Yeah, I tend to, I don't know, I kind of like have this bias against anything that's super popular. It took me forever to read Harry Potter for that reason. I was just like, oh, if everybody likes it, it's probably just me. I did finally get over that. I know that's just snobbery. I did enjoy Harry Potter. I don't like live there. I'm not obsessed with it. I read them once and that was enough. I guess I kind of always go back to the things that were very special to me as a kid. I love a lot of old like English children's literature, like Peter Pan and, The Secret Garden, that's not English, but it was set in England. So it'd probably be more accurate to say I like a lot of the old Victorian children's literature, mm-hmm. even though it was very moralistic. Mm-hmm. There's nobody mm-hmm. writes like that anymore. So I like good language, good vocabulary, good writing.
All right, I'm scouring my notes here to see if I have anything else I wanted to mention. I do have actually a lot of things that I jotted down, but it's stuff I actually want to save for the next episode.
Okay.
Ooh, another episode.
I'll tell you, can I throw something in just about the Black Cauldron?
Please do. If anybody has thoughts they want to add, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, one of the things that I find really, really fascinating in that particular book is how the characters of Adeon and Elladir are, I think, both held up as sort of potential... they're opposites, but they're both potentially what Taran could become, depending on what mm-hmm. types of choices he makes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're very much, you know, these archetypes, and he can go either way. And I think that was quite deliberate. And just once I realized that, gave me kind of a new insight when I reread that book and realized that, you know, Taran, he idolizes one and he really detests the other. And yet after his experience with Adeon's brooch, gets this new understanding of Elladir, and I think he even realizes it at some point that mm-hmm. I could be just like him, you know, depending on how I react to various circumstances. Mm-hmm. And that's a big maturing moment for him.
Yeah.
So this book really, I think the first book introduces the characters really nicely, and it kind of, it endears you to Taran as a protagonist. The second book is really where his true maturation process kind of gets a big push.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the significance of the choices that he has to make and the significance of the consequences of those choices. So it's a very pivotal book.
That's a good point, because when I look at the Book of Three, it's almost got the Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark factor, whereas it probably would have all turned out the same way even if he wasn't there.
Right.
He's kind of forced into these choices. He stumbles into the right answer, whereas he takes those experiences, he builds on them, and then at Book Two, he has to make tough choices, and the tough choices he make actually bring about what really happens.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I really love about the Black Cauldron is it really steps up the character, just the amount of characters and the complexity of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. and you find out, without giving anything away, that there's some friends who turn out to be enemies, and people who you think are enemies who turn out to be maybe not friends, but helpful and protagonists. And mm-hmm. that's just fascinating to me. I think any good characters, you have a little bit of good and a little bit of evil, and you know, sometimes it's hard for you to tell what choices they're going to make, like Dawn was talking about. And Taran is almost like a perfect human being. mm-hmm. He has tough choices to make, and that he almost always makes the right choices, and he's really very, very humble. But then the Black Cauldron, there's a whole lot of different characters, even down to Glue, who is such a spineless coward, but really he's not. He's just playing this little game, and I love that. Mm-hmm. I love the characters.
Just to clarify, are you referring to Gwistle?
Gwistle, sorry.
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
I already lumped those two together in the bad voice acting, so I can understand them still.
They're miserable people, yeah.
But yeah, I agree. Gwistle is a fascinating character.
Okay, yeah.
You know, it's funny. That's actually who, I forget where I read this, but some friend of Lloyd's who read the book said, "Oh, I see you put yourself in the book." And he said, "Well, who are you talking? Are you talking about Fluter?" And he said, "No, it's Gwistle." So apparently, he was a very morose sort of fellow.
Yeah.
Hmm. One other thing that I did notice, and this is the final thing that I'd like to bring up today, is that Lloyd Alexander was writing fantasy in a time where he had several others doing the same thing. I always associated Chronicles of Narnia and the Lord of the Rings very closely with Prydain. The one thing I am not picking up on at all, though, is any overt Christian analogs in this book. Am I missing them? Are they not there? Is there a reason for that?
I don't think they're really there. I mean, I don't know what his personal belief. I know at one point he played with the idea of becoming a minister, and I don't know like what his personal spiritual beliefs were. Mm-hmm. I think the themes in there are sort of cross religious and cross cultural, mm-hmm. just, you know, the themes of love and self-sacrifice and you know, loyalty and humility, which, you know, arguably should be the things that all of the great religions are striving for. But I don't, mm-hmm. I don't personally see, you know, overt references to Christianity in these books. That could just be me.
I think that pulls in your Star Trek theory too. You know, you have these overt themes that are found in lots of fantasy, right. But a complete lack of religion, I think, across the entire, all of the series.
Yeah. Which I think makes them more accessible to more people. Really. I mean, I love Narnia, but I know a lot of people are kind of turned off by the Christian or Christian references in them, which is a shame because they're great books.
It really does hit you with a hammer, though.
Yeah. Lewis is a little heavy-handed. But, you know, that's the audience he was writing for, too, so.
Of course.
Go ahead.
Lewis, did he write the Screwtape Letters or Narnia first? And that may be a really ignorant question, sure. But I'm asking anyway.
Okay. I don't want to. Screwtape Letters was originally a radio broadcast. It wasn't even written as a novel. It was like a radio show. But I don't know when that occurred chronologically.
I think that's rather off topic.
Yeah, you're right.
So the two other things I wanted to bring up was, how does everybody feel about the potential movie?
We haven't thought about that at all.
Oh, gosh. I'm like cautiously excited. To me, because I had to kind of work myself into that space, because I'll be honest, my first reaction was, oh, no. Because although I'd hoped for a movie for decades, I really hoped it was not going to be Disney picking it up. Because, you know, they've had their shot and they screwed it up. It was just, and
you had your, you know,
their track record at accurately adapting a book is not great. at the same time, you know, I don't know. I feel like anything that kind of puts these books back in the public eye. Is a good thing. Yeah. That's kind of what I feel like the only good thing about The Black Cauldron was that it sends some people looking for the books. So the more that can happen, I'm all for that.
Yeah. I think it's kind of a fine line that they have to tread, because fantasy is a huge thing now. You know, with Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings and also a lot of the live action stuff Disney has done again. You know, there's the danger that these are going to look a lot like, you know, kind of mini Lord of the Rings, because there's a lot of similarities. And I'm afraid people might, if they don't pull it off right, might just, you know. And that also makes me nervous that they're going to try to go another direction, because, you know, they don't want people to think it's similar to Lord of the Rings, and it's going to end up being some travesty. So I hope, you know, I hope they kind of are able to tread that fine line.
Yeah. I just want to say and be respectful of it, because it would be so easy to make it just kind of a very generic sword and sorcery. And the story is so much deeper than that, you know. How they cast it, how they direct it. These kids could come off as just really annoying. Or, you know, whether anybody takes the time to really figure out what these stories are really about, instead of just taking them at face value and, oh, this kid, you know, the typical farm boy wants to be your hero shtick. Well, we've seen that before.
Right.
True.
And just, you know, so I'm really, really hoping that they will get someone as a scriptwriter, as a director who's familiar with them and actually cares enough. But Hollywood doesn't have a good track record with that either. So. I'm holding my breath.
I was going to say, I was convinced they never were going to make one. I'd given up hope. So that's why starting to adapt each of the books into a film script and trying to figure out, you know, what's the best way to tell each of these stories on screen with pictures and dialogue. So I adapted all five, and I feel really good about that. And at the time I was like, all right. And even if these never get made, at least something was done besides the 1985 movie. I'm excited about there being a movie, and I've cold called the executive who's in charge, left a message for him. I can try again sometime, see if there's any hope at all. Probably not, but So I'm hopeful and at the same time kind of disappointed. I've spent all this time working on this, and now it's probably not going to get used, and it's probably going to be told in a way other than I thought. But you know, maybe somebody I only came up with what I the best I could do, maybe because someone will find a better way to tell it. You never know.
Hmm. Sarah, you had a question?
So as a not fanatic of the series, I mean, I'm new to it, I'm reading, but I do read a lot of the fantasy genre. Are you at all concerned? My personal experience is that I almost missed the curve with this because I've already read so many stories that have built on what Lloyd Alexander had. So as I'm reading through, I'm like, well, I've heard that. Okay. This was the Aragorn series, which seemed kind of predictable. That, you know, are you a little concerned that these movies are going to cause that effect with the younger fantasy crowd?
Bad question.
Do we have stunned silence, or are we experiencing technical difficulties? So I tell you what, I'll answer Sarah's question. If the connection gets better, then anyone else can pipe in. Yes, I would be horribly concerned about that. The two things come to mind is, number one, how incredibly similar Harry Potter felt to this entire series. I felt like J.K. Rowling, and I mean, she did a great job. I thoroughly enjoyed four of those books. And I read them all, but at the same time, after reading them all, then I go to a book that was written 30 plus years before, and I'm going, okay, so that's where she got this, and that's where she got that, and this is exactly like that, and we'll discuss this more in future episodes, but I kind of hit myself over the head. I always thought that Rowling had stolen from Tolkien, and just, you know, pick and choose a little bit here and there. No. She carbon copied a lot of Lloyd Alexander's creations for her creation and, you know, put it in a different kind of twisted world. But and as much as I enjoy it, can't blame her. It was, I mean, that hit me over the head. So I would be concerned with that. And my other big concern would be that Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the third series in the Narnia movies, I really liked that movie. I thought that movie was spectacular. And I was looking forward to the next two, which are the best two in the series. And of course, Voyage of the Dawn Treader fell flat on its face. And they decided not to make the next two, which I was really looking forward to Silverchair.
Yeah. Me too.
Aren't they going to, didn't they pick that back up?
It was greenlit at some point, but there hasn't been any word on it in the last, I don't know, couple of years.
Okay, I'm going to throw out...
Maybe I should write a letter.
Do it. I'm going to throw out probably, I know, at least an unpopular opinion with Don, because we've chatted a little bit. But I've always thought, when I first started to think about these in terms of a movie, that a 3D animated movie they could actually pull this off. I'd be very excited for either one.
Awesome.
But I don't know. I just think that... the 3D animation has come along so far, and it's done so well. And
after
story is king, to be honest with you, you know. And mm-hmm. I don't know.
You can't get a better story.
Well, after seeing Beowulf and Avatar, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
You know, either one, I'd be happy with either one. I've just thought they could do it. You know? Yeah.
All right. Well, I did want to mention one other thing, and that was that Dawn, you have some endeavors that are tied very deeply to these books. Did you want to mention those at all, or plug yourself at all?
I assume you're talking about my artwork.
Yes.
I've been sort of a hobbyist illustrator on these books for years. I do have a gallery online, but probably the biggest project recently has been the graphic novel that I have been adapting of the Book of Three. And yes, you can find that online. That is on Facebook. If you just Google Prydain the graphic novel, it'll come up. It's also on a website, Comic Fury. Let me, the Book of Three dot thecomicseries.com. So yeah. There will be spoilers there, Ben, also.
And it is spectacular.
Thank you. You know, if you haven't read the book,
it is incredible.
Don't use this as your way to get through it, because, you know, I update maybe a page or two a week, so that's way too slow as far as
I anxiously, even though I know what happens in the books, I anxiously await the next page because I love reading.
Well, I've been working on it as we've talked, so I'm going to try to get the next page up tomorrow, but I can't promise. This has been a crazy weekend.
Yeah, I've loved every page, but I got to tell you, my favorite is the what you did with the Gwythanes. They looked amazing.
Oh, thanks. I tried to stick with things that are kind of, based in reality. The Gwythanes were based off of, I forget now, but it's some type of condor. Or vulture that actually exists. And now that I've actually been to Wales and came back with a enormous supply of photographs and references, I'm really looking forward to. They're in the dungeons right now. I'm really looking forward to getting Taran and Elanwy out of the dungeons and back into the land, so I can start using these references photos that I have, because the landscape is amazing. And so that's going to become a lot more authentic, hopefully.
And we see Fluter.
And we'll see Fluter. Yes, very much looking forward to him.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us. I am hoping that all our co-hosts who are with us today would be interested in doing a second and a third episode where we can discuss the other four books in the series. Absolutely. Does that sound like something everyone would be interested in?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yes.
Terrific. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We hope to see you again soon.
Thank you.